All right, 2 Samuel, chapter number 1. 2 Samuel. Now, you recall when we first started teaching in 1 Samuel, we told you that in the Hebrew Bible, 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel are just one book. Okay, so we're really in the same book. But in our English Bible, it's 2 Samuel that we're dealing with. And I just want to summarize before we get into the scripture tonight what has happened thus far in our story. We know that in chapter number 29, and the Philistines didn't like the fact that David was being allowed to come with them to the battlefield against Israel. King Achish was told, get rid of him. So, not kill him, just get rid of him. We don't want him on the battlefield. And so he sent him home, and it was a good thing, because when David and his forces got back to Ziklag, where they were staying, all their women folk and all their children had been, and all their stuff had been taken. And it had been carried away by the Amalekites. And they got there just in time to be able to find out what had happened and to get on the trail. And all this, you know, God's hand was working through all this. God knew that David didn't need to be fighting against Israel. God knew that David needed to be there to help rescue his family and the families of those that he was, his forces. And they were able to recover everything. They recovered all, didn't lose anything. And then we saw how that the Philistines went on into the battle with Israel, David not being there, David not being privy to what's really going on as far as what's in the battle. And during that battle, just like God had told Saul, he died and his sons died. They got killed in the battle. And that brings us to 2 Samuel chapter number 1. And we see here in 2 Samuel 1 that David has brought the news from the battlefield of the death of King Saul and Jonathan. Let's read the first 16 verses, and I'll make some comments along the way, and then we'll take a look at the verses there. It says in verse number 1, "Now it came to pass after the death of Saul, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and David had abode 2 days in Ziklag, it came even to pass on the third day that, behold, a man came out of the camp from Saul with his clothes rent and earth upon his head." Now that's showing grief. It's showing that he was grieved over something that had happened. And so it was when he came to David that he fell to the earth and did obeisance. And David said unto him, "From whence comest thou?" And he said unto him, "Out of the camp of Israel am I escaped." And David said unto him, "How went the matter? I pray thee, tell me." And he answered, "That the people are fled from the battle, and many of the people also are fallen and dead, and Saul and Jonathan his son are dead also." David said unto the young man that told him, "How knowest thou that Saul and Jonathan his son be dead?" And the young man that told him said, "As I happened by chance upon Mount Gilboa, behold, Saul leaned upon his spear, and lo, the chariots and horsemen followed hard after him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called unto me, and I answered, Here am I. And he said unto me, Who art thou? And I answered him," notice this, "I am an Amalekite. And he said unto me, Stand, I pray thee, upon me, and slay me, for anguish has come upon me, because my life is yet whole in me. So I stood upon him, slew him, because I was sure that he could not live after that he was fallen. And I took the crown that was upon his head and the bracelet that was on his arm, and I have brought them hither unto my Lord. And David took hold on his clothes and rent them, and likewise all the men that were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until even for Saul and for Jonathan his son and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they were fallen by the sword. And David said unto the young man that told him, "Whence art thou?" And he answered, "I am the son of a stranger, an Amalekite." And David said unto him, "How wast thou not afraid to stretch forth thine hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" David called one of the young men and said, "Go near and fall upon him." And he smote him that he died. And David said unto him, "Thy blood be upon thy head, for thy mouth hath testified against thee, saying, I have slain the Lord's anointed." Now, we see that this young Amalekite took Saul's life, supposedly, thinking he was doing Saul, David, and himself a favor. Now, it differs a little bit from the story that we read last week. Okay, guy could have been making up the story, trying to make himself look good in the eyes of David. "Well, you know, here, I had a mercy killing. I helped Saul out. Saul asked me to kill him, and I killed him. And I here, I brought you the crown, and I brought you, you know, his bracelet." And it seems like he's making this up, because if you look in chapter 31, verse number 4. 1 Samuel, back at chapter 31 where we were at last week. "Then said Saul unto his armor bearer," then verse 4, "Draw thy sword and thrust me through." He's talking to the armor bearer, not to an Amalekite. "Draw thy sword and thrust me through therewith, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and abuse me. But his armor bearer would not, for he was sore afraid. Therefore Saul took a sword and fell upon it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he fell likewise upon his sword and died with him." So you got a conflicting story. I believe this account, okay, and I believe that the Amalekite saw an opportunity to lift himself up in the eyes of David. He had an opportunity here. He supposed that he was putting Saul out of his misery, or he thought that would look good in David's eyes, and that he was getting Saul out of David's way. And he knew that there was conflict between David and Saul. No doubt it was general knowledge that those two didn't get along very well. And so, he thought, on those two accounts, you know, I'm going to look pretty good. And he was in the process of gaining David's favor and gratitude. Perhaps he was looking for a form of reward of some kind. But instead of being rewarded, he kindled David's wrath and was put to death. Now we understand David's attitude towards Saul was one that Saul was the Lord's anointed until the Lord took him. Until the Lord took him out. And he wouldn't let his own men kill Saul. And he saw that they did not do that. And you think he's going to let an Amalekite claim to have done that and get by with it? You know, most folks tend to be more shocked that David had this young man killed than that the young man killed Saul. But David was right to put this Amalekite to death on more than one account. Number one, he could and should have killed him simply because he was an Amalekite. Okay, remember where the Amalekites were supposed to be taken out by Saul? And that's in 1 Samuel chapter 15, verses 1 through 3. And also you could look at verses 32 and verse 33. We're not going to go back there again. But he was supposed to wipe them out. He was as good as dead anyway. in David's eyes. He was also obliged to execute him for having killed God's anointed. Oh, you killed God's anointed? You're a dead man. So he was a dead man on two accounts. I mean, if he took that, if he didn't do it, he shouldn't have claimed to have done it because he did himself in. David was right to be angered by the Amalekites' treatment of Saul, and he was right to put him to death. So now let's read verse 17 through the end of the chapter here. It says there, and David lamented with his lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan his son. Also he bade them teach the children of Judah the use of the bow. I'm talking about bow and arrow. Okay, think about who was good with the bow and arrow. Well, it was Jonathan. Okay. And we'll talk about that here in just a minute. And so there in verse 19 says, the beauty of Israel is slain upon the high places. How are the mighty fallen? You'll find that mentioned not only here in verse 19, but it's mentioned again, we'll see in verse 25 and verse 27. Those words are there. And so this is really a poem or a psalm that he's written here. The beauty of Israel is slain upon the high places. How are the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath. Gath was, if you remember, was a Philistine stronghold. Publish it not in the streets of Ascalon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. Ye mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew, neither let there be no rain upon you, nor fields of offerings, for there the shield of the mighty is vilely cast away. The shield of Saul, as though he had not been anointed with oil. In other words, he was killed like a common person. You know, just like he wasn't a king, he was just out there slain on the battlefield, just like anybody else. Verse 22, from the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. In other words, they went down fighting. Is what that's talking about. They were not in retreat. They were going forward in the battle. Verse 23, Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives and in their death. They were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. Ye daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet. Now he's talking about, you know, whenever Saul had his victories, and they would bring home the spoil. And the spoil got divided, you know, with the families there. And so, you know, they were clothed in the scarlet of the enemy and had other delights, he said, with other delights. And who put on ornaments of gold upon your apparel? Whatever they got as far as the spoil, they would bring and they would divide it. And he was talking about what Saul had done there. And then verse 25 says, how are the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? O Jonathan, thou wast slain in thine high places. I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. How are the mighty fallen and the weapons of war perished? Well, we see here in our text, we find David dealing with the loss of his best friend, Jonathan, and Israel's first king. And as we said, three times there, we find the words, how are the mighty fallen. David used this time to instruct the people and to write a memorial for his friend, Jonathan. Now, no doubt the people of Israel were very grieved over the loss of Saul and Jonathan. I mean, you think about the king and in Israel's mind, the crown prince had been slain. I mean, they saw, well, you know, our king was Saul. And, of course, his son was Jonathan. Now, David says there in verse 18, David bade them teach the children of Judah the bow. And I believe it was to take their minds off of their sorrow that David issues this order to teach the children of Israel how to use the bow. And what's going on with that? Well, a couple of different things that I see here. When I was thinking upon this, number one, identification. We've seen before in our study of 1 Samuel 20 how that Jonathan was proficient with the bow. Remember the story of how he was sending out signals with the bow and arrow, how far he would shoot the arrow, and different things there. So teaching Judah the use of the bow would help them to identify with their slain prince and remember him in a positive way that could help them. It was kind of like, be like Jonathan. Let's be like Jonathan. You know, they wanted to. I can see them with their targets there and their bows and arrows and say, "Hey, I'm Jonathan," and you know, and practicing those bows and trying to get good at it. It was really a living memorial, so to speak. If you want to keep a memorial to someone, exhibit in yourself the virtues that shined in them. Right? You know, they were good at something, and it was something that was commendable. Take that on yourself. Manifest in yourself the qualities that shine so brightly in them. That's somewhat of a memorial to them. Now, no memorial is more fit than imitation of one's good qualities. And we too can determine to be a living monument by exhibiting within ourselves all that was good and maybe some of those that we've lost. You know, I've tried to exhibit characteristics to my dad. My dad served the Lord for 45 years, and I got to see that as a boy growing up, and it was a blessing in my life to have him as my dad, and to see that. Well, there are some things in my life that I try to emulate that he showed me. So imitation of a person's positive traits is one of the highest compliments that can be paid to an individual. Now, when David had these people taught to use the bow, think about it. Every time they stringed a bow, they would remember Jonathan. Every time they would shoot an arrow, they would remember Jonathan. And whenever a regiment of archers went through the streets to the battle, they brought Jonathan before their minds, for the mind of the public. And David instituted this form of royal artillery on purpose so that Jonathan might be kept in mind before the people. So, number one purpose in this was identification. Number two purpose in this, I believe, was preparation. Saul and Jonathan had been shot by archers, according to 1 Samuel chapter 31, okay, the last book that we just finished. And look at verse number 3 again. Chapter 31, 1 Samuel, verse 3 says, "And the battle went sore against Saul, and the archers hit him. And he was sore wounded of the archers." The Philistines were evidently good in the use of the bow. You remember me telling you that Israel did much better when they were fighting in the mountains because they did hand-to-hand combat. Well, the Philistines did, they had the chariots. And they'd go in the chariots and they used the bow and arrows and they used the spears, you know, and go by, and that was their method of battle. When this, where they were fighting, was more of a flat land, and Saul's army, with the exception of Jonathan, was evidently weak in the area of archery. And as a result, they were not able to strike the Philistines at a distance, but you know, they were going toward the battle. You know, those arrows came in, hit Saul. Saul and the Israelites could not get into hand-to-hand combat with them, and where Israel might have been a match for the Philistines with that hand-to-hand combat, the arrows reached the king and his son before they could draw their swords. So his thoughts, no doubt, were that if Israel had known how to better use the bow, they might have been the conquerors rather than the conquered. So David hastens here to teach the men of Judah the use of the bow, and this was a positive redirection of both anger and grief. I think we've all seen programs where maybe somebody was shot, a loved one was shot, and that person goes out and gets them a gun, and they go out on the firing range, and boy, they learn how to use that gun, right? And they want to be proficient at the use of that. Why? Well, they're going to get revenge, right, against their enemy. Well, I want you to think about it in the idea here. The children of Judah learning to use the bow could possibly help them in their future battles with the Philistines and other enemies. And they wanted to be like Jonathan. They wanted to be prepared next time that the Philistines would come in that way. And so it was preparation. A third thing that we see is activity. I'm not talking about, it was something to keep them busy. Keep their mind off the grief. Activity can be an effective remedy in the time of sorrow. You know, if you just sit around and mope, sit around and grieve, it tends toward depression and despair and any loss. Positive activity can be invaluable as a comfort. Once you not just sit and brood over their loss. I don't mean that you don't have a period of time where you weep and you cry, but you don't allow yourself to stay there. You've got to get up and get busy. Little good can come from just shutting oneself up to meditate upon the great loss that's befallen them. And that inactivity can inevitably lead to despair, while work or other activity can distract the mind from the sad loss that has taken place. So, little is more healthy than to have something to do and just do it. And so David gave him something to do. Go out and learn how to use the bow and arrow. And go out and do it. And so activity can help to withdraw the mind from the sorrow that tries to overwhelm the soul. And if and when you experience a loss and Satan tempts you to get alone and to try to cease from activity, remember to resist the urge to do that. Try to keep yourself busy. Take a little time to grieve, but don't allow yourself to stay there. David was absolutely correct. The way to raise the people out of their despondency was to teach them the use of the bow, and their own arrows would slay their grief here. And it just kind of brings to mind, I thought about this, remember when Moses died? The Lord kept the children of Israel busy, and Joshua too. And Joshua 1, verse 1 and 2 says, "Now after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass that the Lord spake unto Joshua the son of Nun, Moses' minister, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise and go over this Jordan, thou and all this people, into the land that which I do give them, even to the children of Israel." They were to get their minds set back on God's purpose for their lives, and that was moving on over into the promised land. Yes, they took time to grieve, but there's a time to grieve, but there's a time to get over it, right? And there's a time to move on with your life. And so I think that's what we see here. David helped the people deal with their grief by writing this song, which the daughters of Israel could sing. And this too can help when dealing with grief. How did David manage to speak so well of Saul after all the suffering that he caused David to endure? You know, when you see him talking about Saul here, you don't see him running Saul down, do you? He talks well of him. Well, I think there's several things here. David, number one, trusted in the God whom he served. We need to trust the Lord, don't we? And realize God's in control of everything. David knew that his God, it was a mighty God. And he saw God as being in control of all things. Therefore, God was the one who allowed Saul to pursue him and persecute him. But God kept him hedged in so that Saul could not kill him. God had David in his hands, but he also had his own purposes in allowing Saul to pursue David. Saul was used of God to help prepare David for the leadership role of Israel that he ultimately assumed. You think about, you know, he's got a much smaller army. He learned to direct that army on a small scale basis to help him later on when he assumed the kingship. But his suffering was not in vain. And so he didn't need to feel badly towards Saul. He brings to mind Joseph. Remember, Joseph was able to be grateful for the hand of God in his life through his suffering. Yeah, he suffered. You know, and yeah, it was the fault of his, if you wanted to look at it from a human standpoint, it was the fault of his brothers. But he looked at it from a heavenly standpoint. God allowed it. See? And that's what we have to do. We may look at things from an earthly standpoint and we can get bitter. But if we look at things from a heavenly standpoint, we can see, hey, look, there's no need to get bitter because God's hand's on that the whole time that you're going through it. And just as Joseph was able to be grateful for the hand of God in his life through his suffering, so also David was also able to do the same. A second thing, not only did David trust in the God whom he served, but secondly, David seems to have already dealt with Saul's sin against him by forgiving him. We've seen two instances where he tried to reconcile with Saul. And, you know, even though he knew that possibility existed that Saul was still going to come after him, as he had taken the time and several chapters earlier that we took a look at, and chapter number 26, I believe it was, that where he had reconciled one last time with Saul, and he forgave him, and it appears that David had truly forgiven Saul, and he had no bitterness to suppress or even to vent in this eulogy that he gave of Saul and Jonathan. You know, it's a sad thing to harbor bitterness, because once a person's dead, it's a little bit late to forgive them, isn't it? He had already taken care of it. He had already sought reconciliation with Saul. David didn't have to dredge up the past because he kept short accounts. And we need to remember to do that very same thing in our lives. Keep short accounts. Forgive quickly. You know, because you don't know when your death might come or that other person's death might come. It's too late then. You can't take care of it then. A third thing we see is that David probably thought more highly of Saul than we do. Most folks, including myself, have a tendency to not like Saul very much. In fact, most of us tend to focus on the worst of folks rather than the best. But I want you to note the writer of Samuel. Note back in 1 Samuel chapter 14. He writes two verses here that almost seem out of place. They're really almost kind of like a eulogy or a benediction placed before Saul's downfall. Saul had a time in his life where he did good. Look at verse 47. 1 Samuel 14, verse 47. So Saul took the kingdom over Israel and fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab and against the children of Ammon and against Edom and against the kings of Zobah and against the Philistines, and whithersoever he turned himself, he vexed them. That's a good thing, right? And he gathered an host and smote the Amalekites and delivered Israel out of the hands of them that spoiled them. Now that was before, all of that was before God gave him the command to wipe out the Amalekites and he disobeyed the Lord. I mean, before that point, he had done a lot of good. And like I said, you know, in spite of his ultimate failures, Saul did many things we could be said, you know, the Lord used him in a mighty way there. And in his eulogy, David chose to dwell on the good things, not on his failures. And then last of all, David thinks of Saul in terms of his office, and he honors him in this light. And you see this all the way through the time that David is going through this situation with Saul, is he sees him as king. My Lord the King. He sees him as God's anointed. David provides us with an excellent example of how we are to honor others. The king was God's anointed, and this expression is first employed in 1 Samuel and is used in reference to Saul and then David, and it also refers to future kings, especially the Messiah. The Messiah is the anointed one, right? The Hebrew word rendered anointed is the term transliterated Messiah in the English language. David honors Saul as God's anointed, and in so doing, he honors the ultimate anointed one who was to come. And as the Old Testament revelation progresses, this becomes more and more clear. All right, we're going to put up a stop right there. We'll come back, Lord willing.